America has a tradition of torture, from enhanced interrogation during the Iraq War and struggle against Al-Qaeda, all the way back to the Salem witch trials. Torture has featured prominently in this country's history. Fitzhugh Brundage is the author of a Pulitzer Prize finalist book on how Americans excuse torture at certain times in the life of the Republic. He's also coming to ISU at 7 p.m. Thursday, November 14th in the old main room of the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University. In this Sound Ideas preview, we talk with Brundage about how torture comes during moments of national stress or to control populations such as slaves. Brundage says it flows from a feeling of powerlessness.
The resort to torture has been a reflection of the frustration of Americans in positions of power who have felt threatened by enemies that they did not believe either fought by conventional or traditional means of fighting, or else were so insidious that some extreme measures were needed. I would describe it as a sense of that the impulse to resort to torture is a response to what people in power, the powers that be, perceive to be an extraordinary circumstance that requires extraordinary measures. And so they see it as an exception because they're looking at it in kind of isolation. They're not thinking about how others have done it before, and so they're not drawing connections, historical connections, the way, as a scholar, I am.
That fits the case for torture during the President Bush years. That fits the case for torture during World War II, although war crimes are more common than not common in armed conflict. And it fits the witch trials in Salem, too, if you're thinking of witches as an existential threat to community or civilized life that those people did. How does it fit the case of severe threat or perceived imbalance of power in modern policing or in slavery?
Certainly. In both cases, the implication of your question is slaveholders had unlimited power over their slaves, so why did they perceive themselves as having an existential threat, or modern police have, you know, such enormous capacity to impose their will on populations? So what? I think that's a very good question, because it gets at the root of the matter is, in essence, the perception of people in power about the threat they faced. In the case of modern policing, I think it's been tied to a number of forces or influences, but especially a rhetoric of the war on crime, the idea that there is a thin blue line that stands between ordered society, law-abiding society, and this other world that is completely violent and anarchic, and that the police are really the only thing that is preventing the rest of the civilization, American civilization, of being overrun by criminals who are amoral and nihilistic. They'll just destroy everything. And that rhetoric of the war on crime has been so deeply embedded into the language of American public life from the 1960s on up through, especially during the 1990s and 1980s, when particularly the crack epidemic stoked fears of super predators. It gave police a license to adopt extreme measures because it seemed warranted if you're fighting a war against crime. Going back to the era of slavery, there, in a sense, the slaveholders didn't have to work hard to dehumanize slaves because the enslaved African Americans were already considered to be less than white humans in all manner of intelligence and capacity for feeling emotions and obligation, et cetera, et cetera. And so if the population that needs to be controlled is already dehumanized, then there are fewer constraints. And then on top of that, there's the license that was given to slaveholders to chastise, punish their enslaved humans as they saw fit. And so there was really no limit on the capacity of slaveholders to devise methods of punishment, which sometimes extended to violence that we would describe outright as torture. They themselves saw it as simply the method that was needed to keep their enslaved people in check.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with Fitzhugh Brundage, a historian and a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the author of Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition, and an upcoming speaker at Illinois State University. There is a strand of thought that suggests that the war on crime, the war on drugs, and by extension some of the torture behavior that went with that was motivated, driven politically by racism. And yet you're talking about the fear of a loss of civilization to justify extraordinary and unwholesome means of suppressing crime. Is it possible to tease out race from that fear, or are they entwined?
I think you're absolutely right. They are entwined. The notion that Europeans, that is, white Europeans, were creating the most refined, elevated, sophisticated human civilization ever achieved was deeply embedded in both European and American thought by the 19th century. So the idea that civilization is not some, the idea of civilization is not somehow race blind by any means. It was deeply informed by the notion that the only people who could create an advanced civilization were white Europeans or Euro-Americans. So that's absolutely, if you will, racialized from its conception. But in the 20th century, I think as the United States has moved away from, or I should say the public discourse in the United States has moved away from an outright avowal of white superiority, the rhetoric of white supremacy and white superiority has diminished, and instead we can have rhetoric of civilization being preserved, whether it be against the onslaught of criminals, and the criminals don't really have to be specifically identified as people of color. That's almost taken for granted. And likewise, you don't have to describe terrorists in the white imagination as being specifically non-American and non-white. Often when the term during the war on terrorism was used, war on terror, the languages of terrorists virtually assumed that all terrorists were non-white, non-American. And we often don't use the term terrorist to describe white Americans who are carrying out violence against Americans in a terrorist mode. So I think you're absolutely right. The two are sort of bound together, and it's in that sense, civilization becomes a code word for all of the things that we think are most positive and valuable and important to preserve about the United States. And barbarism or savagery or whatever the opposite of civilization is often becomes synonymous with characteristics associated with people of color.
Is it easier to justify it if we think ourselves virtuous, or is it, does it require more rhetorical hoop jumping than if we did not think ourselves so virtuous?
Well, I think it does make it another wonderful question, because I think it gets at a tension, because the idea of the United States as being founded on a body of principles and law that are humane and progressive I mean that progressive in the long sense of the word, from the 19th century on, the idea that somehow Americans are, to use Abraham Lincoln's phrase, the last best hope for humankind, that notion is a powerful break, if you will, or obstacle to violations of our principles. And yet the idea that those principles of the United States are so sacred that they must be preserved against an existential threat can then also energize those who say, well, we don't like to do this, we don't like to adopt these methods, but given our circumstances, there's no alternative. We must fight our enemies with the tools that we have at our disposal. So in a sense, those same values can, or appeals to those virtues, can lead in two different directions. And I think that's why, at the same time that there has been a recurring resort to torture at times of crisis or perceived crisis in the United States, there has also been strong opposition to the resort to torture.
And yet torture still happens. So
yes.
the rebound, the opposition is either not very effective or it's a function of rebound once it becomes known.
Yes, I think you're right. The challenge is always that I hesitate to use this analogy because it sounds flip, but it's the challenge is sort of like playing whack-a-mole, in that the places, if you will, where the occurrences of violations of American principles or the use of torture can pop up, and then activist opponents will target those and call for some sort of measures. But it's very hard to, because of the dispersal of authority in the United States, with so many different police entities, so many different branches of government having some sort of authority to exercise power over American citizens, it's really hard to ensure that some of those entities aren't engaging in violation. So, I mean, we should not lose sight of the fact that, for example, the Supreme Court over the course of the 20th century made extraordinary inroads in trying to hamper violations of citizens' rights by the police. And to the extent that those violations have continued, those violations have almost always been flagrant violations of norms that the Supreme Court and other courts have tried to establish. The examples of police torture in Chicago and Los Angeles and other cities are literally outright violations of the law and can be punished. The challenge, of course, is to marshal the kind of public will, if you will, the institutional will to punish police forces or sheriff's departments that get out of line. So the challenge then for opponents of torture is to anticipate where violations might happen, to gather together the kind of legal evidence that is necessary to confront often powerful institutions, powerful branches of the government, and to do that in an environment where sometimes there is, for example, during the war on crime, there was a rhetoric that was not sympathetic at all to the rights of alleged criminals, or for that matter, to criminals. I wouldn't want to exaggerate the capacity of the values, if you will, the professed values of American law and civilization to stop torture, but they have a capacity to be marshaled against it and prevent it from continuing, if you will. So they can box it in, if you will.
Fitzhugh Brundage is the author of Civilizing Torture, An American Tradition, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also a speaker at ISU, where the title of his speech will be The Third Degree, Policing and the American Tradition of Torture. So your comments suggest that torture by police ought to be becoming a little more rare based on Supreme Court action and laws curbing the power of police. But police also operate in a constant state of existential awareness that they are representing law. So are they not more prone to torture than perhaps some other areas of public life? And what is the trend for police torture based on those two separate themes there?
I hesitate to make any sort of broad claim about the trend. I do think it is important to recognize that what we may now call police brutality was routine police practice in many, many, many American cities in the early 20th century. To the extent that there were any controls on it, it depended on the police supervisor or superintendent or commissioner, whatever the title might be, in any given city and his preferences. I think it was routine in the early 20th century. I think it'd be fair to say now that there are many, many police departments in the United States where police brutality is uncommon. That's not to suggest that it isn't still a serious national problem. Broadly speaking, I think I will hazard that there has been a decline in the prevalence of police torture across the 20th century. That has many reasons, certainly in part due to the Supreme Court, but also the police now have more and more resources at their disposal to develop evidence that can be used to convict criminals. Whereas in the early 20th century, they had no forensic capacity, they were poorly trained, and they essentially relied on their brawn to elicit confessions, which they could then use to secure convictions. But where I think the problem is really prevalent is in those communities where there really is a sense of chronic lawlessness. And you add that chronic lawlessness with police forces that may perceive themselves as being the thin blue line between law and order and the end of the world. That's the kind of environment where I think we can anticipate that there are going to be police skirting with the very fringes of the law or violating the laws regarding criminals' rights and for that matter, human rights. And remind me of the second part of your question.
The question is, you know, if we've got laws that make it tougher and we have an institutional force that makes it more attractive, how are these two to exist in tension going forward?
That's a very important question. We can envision all manner of possible reforms, sort of piecemeal reforms that might help. That is, every interrogation has to be videotaped or filmed. But, for example, if you make that a rule, then the abuse can happen off the camera. It's very, you know, sort of piecemeal reforms are a tremendous challenge because there'll be those who find ways to skirt them. However, I do think what has been demonstrated over the course of the 20th century is that a kind of continual attention to this, particularly by the courts, it's in response to changing behavior by police forces, but nevertheless, the response can continue to try to suppress whatever new tactics police forces may be using, developing, to violate the rights of alleged criminals or citizens. More broadly, I think the issue is continuing to raise awareness and develop communication across activist groups that are monitoring police behavior across the United States, I think is really important. And I think that has been aided by, of course, advent of internet and the capacity to develop archives of information and share them almost effortlessly and instantaneously. But also, I think the awareness of episodes of police brutality in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, has really elevated attention to this to a level that we haven't seen in decades.
Attention is fleeting sometimes, and your book suggests that torture recurs at moments of stress. There will always be moments of stress in society.
Correct. And so it's as you recount it like that, it's rather depressing. Yes, so I don't want to suggest that I think that it's pointless to try to do anything to address the issue of torture. I think it's, if you will, a moral and societal obligation to try to anticipate where torture might arise and to respond to it very, very quickly with arguments against its allowing it to continue and efforts to try to bring those responsible for torture into courts as quickly as possible. But I do think you're right that, broadly speaking, we can anticipate that it's a very predictable response that when threatened, certain groups, those who have the capacity to do it, will resort to violence. In that regard, the challenge of being ready to confront torture is a persistent, enduring one. But it's a challenge that I just can't see any way for us to shirk. If American institutions, laws, and principles are to be more than just idle words, it's an obligation of for us to enforce them.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Fitzhugh Brundage, historian, is our guest. Earlier, you talked about the idea a society that believes itself a bastion of civilization might actually be more prone to torture because it is defending something that is very precious. Is that American exceptionalism run amok, or is this just par for the course for any advanced civilization?
Excellent question. I certainly do not believe that the United States is a nation that has a tradition of torture on the scale of some other nations during crisis. I might pick Chile during the late 1970s and 1980s, Argentina in the 1970s and 1980s, Zimbabwe for decades, and I could go on and on, North Korea. Those are societies which I think are in a state of truly profound crisis in which torture reaches levels, extreme levels. I don't want to suggest that the United States somehow should be located on some list of perpetrators of torture on a list like that. But your question does get to a good point, which is I think torture is most likely to happen in societies which, as you suggested, are in crisis, but especially societies that are in crisis in which there are great inequalities in power or there are inequalities that are rooted in stark racial, well, this has to do with power, but stark racial or class divisions. And so in the United States, when you combine, not every crisis, I think, is necessarily, not every existential crisis is necessarily going to produce torture. One could have imagined, for example, during the Cold War era, leaving aside the issue of police torture, during the Cold War in the United States, it's not as though the incredible fear of communists in the United States during the 1950s led the FBI to adopt torture to identify communists all over the place. And I think that partially reflected the fact that the FBI and anti-communists tended to identify a type of people as threats who could be gotten at, if you will, without resorting to torture. They, in other words, were enemies, but they weren't dehumanized enemies that somehow fit for torture. And it also had to do with the fact that we were using accusations of torture in the Soviet Union as an example of how our principles were superior to the Soviet Union's principles. So all of this is to say that I think that torture is more likely in moments of crisis, even in an advanced society, but one can anticipate, and in fact one can find examples of societies, advanced societies, where they have criminal justice systems that are not as prone to torture as the United States, or that have gone through crises without resorting to torture as we have.
Fitzhugh Brundage is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his book, Civilizing Torture and American Tradition. He'll be speaking at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Fitzhugh Brundage will be the Robert Bone Lecturer at ISU Thursday, November 14th in the Old Main Room of the Bone Student Center at 7 p.m.